Welcome to the Westminster Effects Doxology Podcast, where we explore popular practices, songs, and ideas in the modern church world in the light of sola scriptura and tota scriptura. I'm Cody Fields, president of Westminster Effects. Go buy stuff for your guitar at westminstereffects.com and join the group, join the discussion in the Westminster Effects Doxology Podcast Lounge on Facebook. There's over 300 of us in there, and it's a good time. And make sure you subscribe on Spotify or Apple Podcasts or YouTube and, you know, follow us, blah, 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 blah. Give us a review, 5 stars. We're not joined by Luther and John, but I am joined in person by...
Hey, everybody. Bradley Cox, pastor at Resurrection Church in Greer, South Carolina.
So we've had an interesting discussion going on the last, couple weeks in our church. We are in the middle of a series teaching through the minor prophet Habakkuk, which is not tremendously popular to do for one. But we also kind of hit the fact that the ESV in chapter 2, verse 1, flubs that translation of Habakkuk 2:1. And so you and the elders got to thinking, well, maybe it's time for a change. And you've already been studying in the NASB and then teaching out of the ESV recently.
Yeah.
And so this is, you listeners, you're basically seeing how the sausage gets made a little bit.
Yeah. So let's just talk about the specific verse that you're mentioning here.
Yes.
And
then there's another one I want to hit.
Okay. So Habakkuk, let me just pull it up here. I apologize for the delay.
We're very prepared around here.
But the ESV, Habakkuk chapter 2, verse 1, this is after Habakkuk offers his initial complaint to God about the condition of Judah and also the threat of the Chaldeans or the Babylonians that's coming. God responds to Habakkuk basically saying, I'm raising up the Chaldeans to judge my people, and then I'm going to turn around and judge the Chaldeans for their wickedness.
Yep.
And Habakkuk then responds again with what could be perceived as another complaint, but we could talk about that if you want. But he rehearses the paradox.
Right.
The paradox that he feels, I think, is captured at the end of chapter 1 where he says, God, I know you are of pure eyes, cannot look upon wickedness with favor.
Mm-hmm.
And then he turns right around next verse or next phrase and says, why do you look with favor upon those who deal treacherously?
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like Habakkuk feels like, it, from his perspective, it seems like God is acting out of character.
Right.
But then you come to chapter 2, verse 1, and this is how he wraps up his second complaint, if you want to call it that. The ESV renders it this way. I will take my stand at the watchpost and station myself on the tower and look out to see what he will say to me and what I will answer concerning my complaint, which seems to indicate, just at a surface reading of that, that Habakkuk has finished his second complaint and he's anticipating a third.
Yep.
In other words, I'm not going to be happy with God's answer. He's not going to explain himself in such a way that jives with my sensibilities, so I'm probably going to complain again. That's the way it sounds to me. Mm-hmm. Here's how the NASB, the NASB, reads on chapter 2, verse 1. I will stand on my guard post and station myself on the rampart, and I will keep watch to see what he will speak to me and how I may reply when I am reproved, when I am corrected.
That is entirely different.
It's entirely different in terms of Habakkuk's posture.
Right.
Is he anticipating a third complaint, or is he literally saying, God, I don't understand you. I'm going to wait for your response, and then I'll see how I will respond when I am corrected because I realize the problem is me, not you.
Yes.
And that is a tremendous difference. Mm-hmm. In my opinion, or in the elders' opinion here at Res, that has a dramatic effect on how we might read that verse.
And this isn't to dunk on the ESV at all, because for the most part, the ESV is a really, really, really good translation.
Right, and we'll come back to that. But I think that it, you know, it's an example of how translations can differ, and you know, I am not, and in fact, none of our elders are experts in original language, Hebrew or Greek. We rely heavily on, you know, concordances. And I use Bible Hub all the time, BibleHub.com.
Oh, yeah.
And I have the interlinear open every time I'm studying.
Yep.
Even if it, whether it's personal study or preparing to teach, I have that interlinear open. And I'm comparing because there are times when words are translated differently, and I want to make sure I'm getting as close to the original as I possibly can.
Right.
And I don't think I have to be an expert in original language in order to be able to test even the most reliable translations.
Right.
And so as we looked at the interlinear on BibleHub.com, we realized the word does not mean complain.
Right.
It's used 28 times in the Old Testament, and almost every time it's translated in the ESV, in the NAS, New King James, King James, it's translated correct or reprove or rebuke, which says to me that that's more than likely that is, we could be reasonably certain that Habakkuk's posture was that he expected to be corrected, not complain again.
Yes.
And therefore, we did something pretty dramatic for our church. It may not sound dramatic to everybody, but it felt it felt weighty and dramatic to me that instead of teaching from the ESV like we normally do, we taught from the NASB on Sunday because we felt like that was such a crucial word to understanding the text. Because the goal is always to understand what the author originally intended.
I think they do something similar with chapter 2, verse 5 as well. So, moreover, this is the ESV. It says, moreover, wine is a traitor, an arrogant man who is never at rest. His greed is as wide as Sheol, like death he has never enough. He gathers for himself all nations and collects as his own all peoples. So, just on its face, it's basically saying wine is doing all of those things. So I'm reading from the Legacy Standard, so as James White calls it, the NASB Perfected. So step up your game, Bradley. but I'm giving the LSB a test run since this has been a conversation.
Sure.
And so the LSB, which is dang near identical to the NASB anyway, says, and indeed, wine betrays the haughty man so that he does not stay at home. He enlarges his appetite like Sheol, and he is like death, never satisfied. He also gathers to himself all nations and assembles to himself all peoples. So it's the haughty man doing those things under the influence of wine, or too much wine, rather, right? Because it's out of his pride that he overindulges.
Right, and it, rather than personifying wine,
right,
which some Bible translations do a similar thing with sin.
Yeah.
Personifying sin.
Right.
Sometimes at, you know, maybe the expense of understanding that sin is not a person. People sin.
Right.
And so, yeah, I think that's interesting.
Yeah. And even considering there are other prophecies, and I don't know them off the top of my head, that uses similar language about the nations being drunk with power and stuff like that. And that's why they do these things. It's not that wine itself is a traitor. It's simply the overindulgence in it that ends up betraying you,
right?
And
I think what we see in the NAS and Legacy Standard is a more vivid focus on what the main point is that wine is actually exposing, all the more, the wickedness of the arrogant man's heart,
right? Exactly.
And that seems to be the point there,
right? And it's his appetite is like the grave.
Yeah.
Right? It's not the wine. Wine, repeatedly, especially in the Old Testament, is a blessing.
Yes.
And it's the absence of it that's a curse.
Exactly.
It's just this guy treated it like his God. Just like in the previous chapter of the Chaldeans sacrificing to their fishing nets. But also there's an interesting parallel here of gathering for himself all nations. That should sound familiar if you've ever read Matthew 28.
Yeah.
Right. Disciple the nations, as opposed to the Chaldeans gathering to themselves all nations.
Yeah.
So anyway,
Well, let's talk about, like, you know, just to make sure that, you know, we've got a foundation to talk about this from.
Yes.
I imagine most of our listeners know this, what I'm about to say, but maybe some don't. There are categories of translations.
Right.
The category of translation that we use, and I think most churches, at least, that opt for expository teaching as opposed to topical teaching, mm-hmm. use what's called formal equivalence translations. You know, Working Man's Definition would be word-for-word translations.
Right.
In that category is where you're going to find the English translations of the English Standard Version, the ESV, the New American Standard Version, the NASB, the CSB, mm-hmm. Legacy Standard, obviously, New King James, and even the Old King James
yep.
is a formal equivalence or word-for-word translation.
The main shortcoming, the King James is a fantastic translation.
It really is.
For what they had to work with.
Yes.
Because they had 6 manuscripts, and now we have 5,000.
Right.
But, you know, the King James translators did an incredible job.
They did.
And particularly considering they did that in the 1600s.
Exactly.
Oh my goodness, we couldn't pull that off right now.
No.
The two of us sitting here, I mean.
Right.
But yeah, they did a great job. It's just they expected that as scholarship improved, their work would be improved on. Which just demolishes King James onlyism. Anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, get James White going on that.
That's funny. Right.
But, you know, that is the category of translation that I think, I don't know. I'll just say it this way. People that opt for more expository style teaching, going mm-hmm. line by line, verse by verse, being very attentive to the text and what the authors wrote and were inspired to write, you're going to find those people gravitating towards formal equivalence. The
right.
other is dynamic equivalence, or a Working Man's Definition would be thought for thought.
Mm-hmm.
This is where we find the NIV, the New Living Translation.
Mm-hmm.
What are some others? I can't even.
Well, some people would say the Message, but that's not really even.
That's in a category all by
yeah.
itself.
You could say the Amplified Bible. If you want to get
the Amplified is also kind of in a category by itself,
okay,
because
fair.
Amplified is a Bible that or translation that takes each word and gives you all the possible
That's
definitions.
True. Yeah.
And that, you know,
that just opens up a can of worms.
It does. And I don't think it's helpful.
Right.
Because words don't always mean the same thing in every context. If
right.
I say trunk,
mm-hmm.
well, that could mean anything from the long gray thing on the front of an elephant's nose to where you put your groceries when you finish shopping at the grocery store to drive home.
Right.
And as well as a storage bin in your home that you refer to as a trunk. I mean, words don't always mean the exact same thing in every context. And the Amplified giving you every possible definition,
mm-hmm.
I think is more confusing than helpful,
yes,
generally
absolutely.
Speaking.
Yeah.
And the Message is, you know, let's call it what it is. It's not a Bible translation.
Right.
It's a commentary.
Right.
And it's specifically Eugene Peterson's commentary mm-hmm.
and
on
the
Bible.
He was adamant that it was not a translation.
He was. But most people think of it as a translation rather than a commentary. Now, dynamic equivalence translations like the NIV, although I think the NIV has gotten significantly better over the years, from what I've heard. I don't read the NIV much, but you know, even Brian Onken has said that the NIV has improved.
Okay, fair. I haven't
lived it, but those kinds of translations border on being commentaries.
Yeah,
because they're opting for what's the general sense that's being said here, rather than what were the actual words that were written.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think you have to make some decisions. Every church, every eldership has to make decisions about what kind of translations are we going to use in the church.
Yeah.
The ESV is when we made the switch from topical to expository teaching, we obviously said, okay, we've got to be consistent in the translation that we're using.
Right.
And so we opted for the ESV because this was my thinking at the time. It seemed to be the most readable of the formal equivalence translations.
Yep.
And so that's why we went with it.
And honestly, most people think that.
Most people think that. And I think that, like you said, the ESV is a solid translation. Any translation, really, in the formal equivalence category is something that you can be, you know, confident in,
right.
I think.
Right.
It's just over time, I keep running into little things with the ESV that I don't like.
Or they tried, it's like they tried to massage it just a little too much.
Just a little too much. And so I don't know. A switch in our church feels like a really big decision to me for a couple of reasons. One is, over the years, as our church has grown and people have, you know, become more and more attentive to the text we're studying and reading the text, people have bought ESV Bibles.
Right.
And they, you know, I don't know if everybody feels this way, but I think a lot of people do. Is you're pretty attached to your Bible. Like, I know where things are.
Right.
In my specific Bible.
That's literally my only hang up right now.
Yeah.
That and figuring out if I want to go NASB 95 or LSB.
Yeah.
But between those, like, I know where things are. My main Bible is a Reformation study Bible. I'm not one to write in my Bible. I don't want to know what stupid thing I thought 4 years ago.
Fair. That's fair.
And you know, the Reformation study Bible also has those really helpful notes. I'm not one to be distracted by those.
Yep.
Like, I can just read the text and enjoy it. And then if I get, all right, I got a question. Oh, look, they have an answer there. Mm-hmm. But I can get an electronic version of that for $25 and have it on my phone or on my iPad and just pop the thing up whenever I want.
There you go.
So that, you know, now it's, you know, the trade-offs between the LSB. I really like the fact that they translate what is normally translated as all caps Lord in the Old Testament as Yahweh. Because
yes.
That's what it is.
That is. Yes, right.
The thing I like about the NASB over the LSB is the translation of dominion. Is the NASB has dominion, where the LSB has might, which is not wrong, technically speaking, but there are implications to that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, at the same time, you know, like with Revelation 1:6, 27:16, a little biased toward it, it does say all might and authority. So it's the same thought. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing being conveyed. You don't lose anything there.
Yeah.
So, but, there's always trade-offs with every translation, right?
Mm-hmm. I think there are, and I think that...
It's just like economics.
Right. But I think, this is the other reason that the decision feels weighty to me is that I don't want our people to lack confidence in the Bibles in their laps.
Right. And I don't think our people will.
I don't either, but I have a concern about that because I want people to know. I don't want people going, you know, well, I'm not a Greek or Hebrew expert. I haven't been to Bible college or seminary. How am I going to know in my translation if there's a word like that? That
just don't use the Passion. You'll be okay.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But like in my small group, I know that we have ESV, CSB, which, for the record, the CSB is the most arrogantly titled Bible translation.
Yeah.
It is the standard for Christians.
Yeah.
I know we have ESV, CSB, New King James, and Old King James, at least.
Yeah.
There might be another one or two.
Yeah.
Maybe someone uses the NASB. So at least for my group, that wouldn't be a problem because they're all attached to what they're using anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, and I'm hopeful that our people would adjust accordingly without, you know, having serious concerns raised about, can I trust the English Bible in my lap? And if we do make the switch, I'm hopeful that and prayerful that we'll be able to convey the reasons why without causing there to be some insecurity, you know, in that regard. Because I do think that any formal equivalence translation is something that, you know, the average, ordinary, everyday Christian, which I don't mean that to sound derogatory in any way, but, you know, the Bible was meant, God intended the Bible to be read and understood by everyday ordinary people.
Yes.
You do not have to go to seminary. This is something that we talk about a lot here at Res. You do not have to go to seminary. You do not have to have a library full of books about the Bible in order to understand the Bible itself.
Right.
God intended it to be read and understood by his people. And so I think it's important for us to have confidence in our English translations, particularly in the formal equivalence category. So we want to be able to convey this switch if we indeed make it, which that decision has not been made officially yet, mm-hmm. Although it seems to be trending that way.
Yeah.
That you can trust your English Bible. Just make sure you're in the formal equivalence category.
I think there's something to be said as well for, I'm not saying anything about our church. Don't hear me say that. Because our people read and dig and we've attracted that kind of person over sure. the years. Mm-hmm. And the people who have stuck around have, for the most part, said, yeah, I'm buying into that approach. There is also something to be said that a lot of Christians need to be pushed on reading comprehension and reading in general.
No, totally.
Where we have this American culture of, you know, being opposed to reading, being opposed to anything intellectual, being opposed to actually digesting large chunks of information, stuff like that. And so I honestly think a lot more people are a lot more capable of reading things like the NASB, LSB, etc., than they think they are.
No, and that's true. And I think that I remember when I switched to the ESV that I felt like I was pushing the church at the time because I, in fact, I was looking back at some old sermon notes from like 15 years ago, not just recently.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed how often I was using the NIV, the New Living Translation. I was using those dynamic equivalence translations quite a bit, and it felt like we were pushing the church mm-hmm. in a good direction when we switched to the ESV. And
right.
and our people have, man, they've bought in. I mean, there's a yeah. People do need to be challenged and pushed to read and mm-hmm. to read with comprehension and to read with intentionality. And I don't think we should be afraid to do that at all. My point in, you know, switching translations and it causing some insecurity is that I don't want people to feel like they can't trust their ability to just simply read the English words on the page mm-hmm. and understand them. That's important to me mm-hmm. because I think even mm-hmm. I'll say this about Habakkuk chapter 2, verse 1. Even with that word being translated wrongly, in my opinion, in the ESV, I still think you can come away from the book of Habakkuk with the right understanding and the right conclusion about
right.
what
no,
God
absolutely.
Was communicating to the prophet about himself and about his ways.
Mm-hmm.
You can come away with the right understanding.
Yes.
We're not talking about something that's going to lead us into heresy.
Right.
We're just talking
like
about
the passion.
It, like the passion would. That's exactly right. But this is just something that does have a significant effect on how we understand Habakkuk's posture mm-hmm. at that specific moment in the book.
Yes. So to recap, we saw an issue mm-hmm. cause a little bit of a hiccup. Mm-hmm. We're kind of, you've reevaluated for your personal study anyway.
Yes.
And now we're kind of on that verge of it's not the verge of reevaluating. We are reevaluating, is this the best translation for the church? Mm-hmm. Switch might happen. Maybe.
I think it probably will.
Yeah. But it's
at some point anyway.
The goal of it being to read in English as close to the original language as possible.
Yes.
Because we understand, you know, Hebrew is a written right to left language, so that would be really awkward to read in English.
Yes.
So we're still going to read left to right, but you know, things like the NASB, ESV, etc., they give us as close to that as we can get.
Right. It, you know, if anybody's ever played the telephone game, it's like, you know, you whisper something in somebody's ear and then you go down the line of half a dozen people, and by the time it gets to the last person,
it's just
it can get all convoluted. So I want a translation that's as close to what was originally written as possible. And I would encourage people, even those that listen that do not, they've never been to Bible college or seminary, they feel like there's man, there's no way I could, you know, dive into original language or whatever. Take a look at BibleHub.com.
Mm-hmm.
When you're reading in your personal study, Old or New Testament, just pull up the interlinear.
Yep.
And it's a little awkward in the Old Testament to read from right to left in that.
Yep.
But just look at that resource over each word, because you can click on each word and you can look at what the information that's provided there about that word, particularly all the other places in the Old or New Testament where that word is used,
mm-hmm.
which allows you the opportunity to contextually look at, you know, is this a similar context to the place that I was just reading?
Yep.
And does it help me understand that word a little better? Is it translated differently? You know, really anybody that can read can do that.
I even use Bible Hub on the fly in our small group discussions.
Oh, I do that all the time.
Like if we have a question on, well, what does that word mean? Well,
just pull it up.
Here you go. Here's what this means, and here's the other verses that it's in.
Exactly.
It's super easy. It's a really good resource.
The other thing I'd say, too, this NASB Bible that I just bought is a reference Bible.
Yes.
Which is so helpful in that every verse has corresponding cross-references.
Yeah.
And it even has, noted specific words that and phrases that you will find in these other places.
Yep.
And that's been very helpful to me, you know, in trying to understand what was being said.
And another thing that I really like about the NASB and LSB is anytime there's a quotation of the Old Testament in the New Testament, it's all caps.
Yes.
So even if it doesn't say, as the scriptures say, you know, here you go, here's your quote.
It's in all caps.
It's all caps regardless, even if it's not in quotation marks.
Exactly.
Which really just slaps you in the face and says, pay attention to me. Mm-hmm. Something's happening, and you should probably understand both parts of the Bible.
Yes.
Not just this one part.
Yeah.
So any parting things before we go to the Inquisition? Or any final thoughts, rather?
I think, I don't know. I like what you said. I mean, like, I just want to encourage people to be more attentive.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. It really, if you have a good Bible dictionary and a good concordance,
mm-hmm.
alongside your formal equivalence translation, you are more than adequately equipped to read and understand the scripture. And the good news about BibleHub.com or BlueLetter.com is that you've got both a really good concordance and Bible dictionary right at your fingertips.
Yep.
And so I would just encourage people to include those things in your reading. Don't automatically opt for commentaries. They can be helpful. Mm-hmm. Like you said, the study notes in the Reformation Study Bible are helpful.
Yep.
But
sometimes they miss it.
Yep.
Yep.
If you're in a dynamic equivalent translation, consider switching to a formal equivalence.
Mm-hmm.
And then bring along blueletterbible.com or BibleHub.com and mm-hmm. enjoy the ride. It's a lot of fun.
And BibleHub has an app for the iPhone. So
does it really?
Yeah, right here. So, I mean, right there, and then interlinear's right there on the bottom right.
Oh, that's so helpful.
Yeah.
It's so much better than the browser. I need to get that.
Yeah.
I didn't know that was there.
Yeah, so this is what I'm popping open during small group discussions.
I like it.
So it's awesome, man. It's a really good, clean app.
Get that right now.
So... yeah, you're welcome for that.
Really
that
good.
That and while we're talking about it, the Daily Bread app is basically a Bible reading checklist. So you can go to this one just popped up, Jeremiah, and as you read a chapter, you can check it off. You can check all of them if you read it all in one go. You can uncheck it all or whatever. So if you don't want to use like the Bible app and you know, click into a separate app and then wade through its minutia to get to your reading plan. If you're just on a set number of chapters or whatever,
right?
You just use that. So
that's awesome.
Yeah. So the Daily Bread app, Bible Hub app. Yeah. Go enjoy those.
That's great.
Inquisition?
Yes.
This is the Inquisition, where we take your questions and answer them on the fly, which honestly isn't all that different from the rest of the show. This week, we just have one question that's been left over from the last couple of weeks that's really interesting. So, all right, are you ready to get into the weeds?
Let's do it.
Okay. Frank Aiken asks, was Satan already a fallen angel when he tricked Adam and Eve, or was God's curse on him where we see God casting him from heaven? If Satan had fallen prior, then wouldn't sin have already entered the world?
I think...
This is a really good question.
It is a really good question. I don't know.
You could make the case. So the way that Michael Heiser frames this is that God created man to rule the seen realm, and then he created what the Old Testament refers to as the sons of God to rule the unseen realm. And Satan and his buddies would have been among those who were created to rule the unseen realm and for one reason or another didn't like what God was up to and rebelled. Mm-hmm. Right. So whether he's an angel or a son of God, however you treat that language, whatever. And it could be that Jesus saying that he saw him fall from heaven could be more metaphorical language. It's not literally being cast down from the sky onto earth. It would be he fell from heaven as in he fell from his position of this unseen realm in some amount of authority.
I actually don't think that's what Jesus was talking
fair.
About.
That's fair. I'm just postulating at the moment. Yeah.
I don't have any reason to disagree with what you said about
up until that one part.
Yeah. I mean, I think when Jesus, this is just, I mean, I'm open to being debated on this, but when Jesus says to his disciples, I saw Satan fall like lightning mm-hmm. from heaven, you know, that's contextually, that's when they've just come back from their first missionary tour.
Okay.
And yep, they're telling right. him about yep. all the things that they've done. Lord, even the demons are subject to us in your name. Mm-hmm. And he does give them some instruction there, but I think his reference to, I saw Satan falling like lightning is literally a metaphorical picture of Jesus saying, as you went out in my name, I saw Satan's kingdom crumbling.
Okay, fair, yeah.
In the
yeah.
present moment.
I like that better anyway.
But, I mean, if anybody wants to go toe-to-toe on that, I'm open to yeah. being told I'm wrong. But anyway, I don't disagree with that, you know, the sons of God or angels were created to rule the unseen realm and the that man was created to rule the seen realm. When did Satan fall? I struggle to imagine that his fall did not happen before the temptation in the garden.
Mm-hmm.
I struggled with that because is that act his fall?
Right.
How did he rebel? I've never thought of it that way.
Right.
That's a great question. And yeah. I'm going to probably, you know, hold back from making any confident assertions about things that I don't know.
Yeah.
You know,
I think this is one of those things that I've mentioned before. Heiser handles a lot of things really well, and then he comes way out of left field on others. And I think this is one of the ones where he handles it pretty dang well. It wasn't, more than likely, it was not a literal snake coming up to Adam and Eve.
Right.
It was probably one of these sons of God that Adam and Eve were used to seeing. And then he says, did God really say that? Are you sure? Which is why they didn't freak out. The reason they call him the serpent is more than likely a polemic against ancient Near Eastern cults that worshipped serpents. Mm. And so when God says, he curses Satan and says, you're going to crawl on your belly, it's not God taking away snakes' legs like some have said about Genesis, mm-hmm. it was, this is going to be your position from now on, is that's how low you are.
Yeah, you know, that's, I mean, I don't know, that's intriguing.
Yeah.
This is just my, I don't know, some people might think I'm a little oversimplistic. That's fine. I'm okay with that criticism. The Bible just doesn't say
right.
explicitly.
Right.
And I think that there are things God has told us we need to know without giving us the full story.
Yep.
And without telling us why it's important that we actually know. Mm-hmm. What do we know? Satan mm-hmm. fell.
Yep.
Satan rebelled against God. When did that happen? How did that happen? Was he a literal snake in the garden, or was it mm-hmm. like an angel of light that mm-hmm. a son of God? Like, the Bible is not explicit about that. What we do know for certain is that he fell, mm-hmm. that he tempted Adam and Eve. They fell, and sin entered the world.
Yep.
Had that same kind of sin already entered the unseen world before it entered the seen world? I don't know the answer to that.
Yep, exactly.
What I do know is that sin happened right. in the unseen realm, and Satan and his cohorts were cast out of heaven.
Right.
And then at some point sin entered the world. And we know the effects of that. So that's where I tend to live, and I, you know, right. here's the concern I have about, you know, Paul talks about in 1 Timothy. In fact, it might even be worth reading. It's not a direct application per se.
Is it worth reading out of which translation?
I'm going to read it out of the NASB. So fasten your seatbelts, ESV people. Here's what he says. He says, but the goal of our instruction, and let me preface, one more preface. I'm not saying that the person you just mentioned is this person that Paul's talking about.
Right.
Directly. I'm just warning. The goal of our instruction, this is 1 Timothy chapter 1, verse 5. The goal of our instruction is love from a pure heart and a good conscience and a sincere faith. For some men, straying from these things, have turned aside to fruitless discussion, mm-hmm. wanting to be teachers of the law, even though they do not understand either what they are saying or the matters about which they make confident assertions. Not apples to apples.
It's the confident assertions part that you got to be careful.
You got to be careful about. And I just think that people get so intrigued by speculation. We all speculate some.
Yes.
When we interpret scripture.
Yeah.
There's no way around that. We fill in blanks, and we do that as carefully and thoughtfully, prayerfully as we can. But if you get too confident about assertions, about speculations, then I think it can lead you into some dangerous territory.
Right.
And I would just be careful with that.
And that's, you know, one of the caveats that Heiser makes in there is we don't have the whole story from Scripture writ large.
That's right.
There are hints at certain things, like Jesus says, a kingdom divided against itself can't stand. He's like, we don't have in the Bible a specific verse that says Satan is the singular leader of this pack of demons and they all have unwavering loyalty to him. It could be, and he's, you know, making this caveat, it could be that there is division in that kingdom. They could have arguments with each other over how to do things, kind of like Screwtape Letters. Of you have the more mature demon writing to, you know, obviously that's fiction, we get that.
Yeah.
You know, you, and that's where certain podcasts like Haunted Cosmos, I think, are helpful, where they're taking accounts of things, even like Bigfoot, seriously, and just looking at the evidence. All right, what does the Bible say? Does the Bible say a whole lot about this? No, maybe. Well, it's probably a demon anyway, but but it's, you know, they're saying we don't have the full picture. There's yeah. something going on out there that we don't know every single thing about.
Yeah.
And that's okay.
Yeah. And we're intrigued by that mystery.
Yes.
And yes. and God
sometimes
has
sometimes we go overboard.
Sometimes we go overboard. But God has given us revelation.
Yep.
That, you know, it's just, we just did this Bible study where Paul talks about in 1 Thessalonians his longing and just overwhelming desire to get back to Thessalonica after he was torn away after what best we can tell, might have been only 2 weeks of ministry there initially.
Right.
And he says, but Satan hindered us. And we wrestled with what does that mean, that Satan hindered. If you look at what Paul is saying there in context, it's clear that Paul does not see the opposition as legitimately sabotaging the ministry he was called to.
Right.
If it is a hindrance, it's only a hindrance to the degree that it is furthering the advancement of God's kingdom agenda, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. It doesn't ultimately or utterly sabotage or hold back the church from moving forward.
Right.
The hindrance is actually something God is, what, you know, what you intended for evil, Joseph said, God intended for good.
Yep. So not that he used it for good.
Right.
He intended it for
good. He intended it for good. So anyway, I don't know. Long answer to a short question is I don't know.
It's worth considering.
I wouldn't say it doesn't matter.
Right. It matters, but at the same time, you're not going to get a cut and dry proof text.
Yeah. And I personally, I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time thinking about such things.
Right.
Because I think it could be a distraction from the more important issues.
This would be one of those where you don't have a lot going on like a Tuesday, and you spend like an hour on the internet seeing what different people say about it. And then you're like, okay.
And so, and sometimes, I mean, again, I'm not trying to speak negatively about whoever this is you mentioned earlier, but sometimes I find myself skeptical of so-called scholars who spend an enormous amount of time on these things, particularly the ones that, you know, write books or put out things for sale, because people get so intrigued by this stuff, and I question how helpful that is.
Especially guys like Jonathan Kahn.
Oh, totally.
Who just lives up to his name.
Yes.
Or the pronunciation of his name. Yeah. Guys like Jonathan Kahn, John Hagee.
Oh, man.
Anybody,
it's awful.
Anybody connected to the New Apostolic Reformation. Have you seen this new one? Catherine Crick.
Her
claims
name
to be
popped
an apostle,
up somewhere.
And oh, man, it's bad. So
avoid such people.
Avoid such people. Mark and avoid, as the King Jimmy says. Mm-hmm. So anyway, on that note, you got anything else real quick? Other than don't freak out about it.
Love God, love people. What is it you say?
Love God, love your neighbor. Go Makes Music. We'll see you next time.